up to 20% level, and the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran to launch a plant to produce metal uranium in Esfahan. It would also revive heavy water reactor within 2 to 4 months. The number of centrifuges would also increase. This would be a clear blow to the IAEA and the world powers, since Iran has been compliant in working with the organization. But Parliament has also sent a 3-month deadline for it to stop applying additional protocols of the IAEA, a draft bill that will also require the Iranian government to stop any IAEA inspections beyond additional protocol. All of this should sound familiar, since they were part of the JCPOA. But now, Iran is arguing that enough is enough. The JCPOA wasn't even fully operational, and that it had become a tool for the European signatories to apply pressure on Iran, whilst allowing the EU to remain on the fence when it came to treading between Iran and the United States.
Well, ever since the United States, at the behest of Donald Trump, left the JCPOA, and I believe that's about 2.5 years ago, there has been repeated urgings by the European powers that are still in the agreement and the other powers that are still in the agreement beseeching Iran to wait, that they'll do something, they'll take measures to help relieve the problem of the sanctions imposed by the United States. But as far as we can see, very, very little has happened. So it comes to a point where now we have another assassination of a leading scientist, leading official. We have word from Washington that the Trump administration and Trump himself is thinking, can we have a military strike on Iran? So, given these circumstances, I don't think that the Iranian government had any choice but to take further action.
When the US pulled out of the JCPOA under the executive order of Donald Trump, the EU stated that they would remain committed to the accord and continue to respect the terms and conditions of the agreement. Yet, the EU have simply used their rhetoric to sit neatly on the fence and neither respect or disregard issues such as trade, sanctions, and diplomacy with Iran. Yet, with Donald Trump still at the helm at the White House, at least until January, the EU must now start to lobby support from President-elect Joe Biden, which is something that should not be too difficult, as Biden himself has stated that he would like to re-enter the JCPOA once he takes office. Yet for Iran, the options that lie ahead are plentiful when it comes to managing how it will emerge from the assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, and how it plays out its diplomatic options in the future, with the expansion of its peaceful civilian nuclear program being just the first step. But what other options then could Iran also choose?
Well, for one thing, Iran could have the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, inspectors leave. The inspectors, ever since the JCPOA was put into place in 2015, they have over and over and over again stated that Iran is meeting all the conditions of the JCPOA. But why would Iran continue to meet the conditions of the JCPOA when other countries are not? And when their adherence to the conditions of the JCPOA, the Iranian government's adherence to them, has not produced anything that is helpful to Iran. And in fact, the situation has gone downhill.
Does this then mean that the Israeli regime has shot itself in the foot by assassinating Fakhrizadeh? Already many nations across the globe have condemned the act, and the consequences now mean that Iran has the upper hand. Should the future lead to the negotiating table, with Iran able to cite the illegal actions of the Israeli regime as a key reason to undermine the Zionist government of Netanyahu and co. For Iran, as a force for peace in the region and the rest of the world, the time has come for it to progress into the future, having defiantly beaten the maximum pressure policy imposed by Trump, and show the world that it's a cooperative partner. Yet should the need arise, it can still continue on its very capable path without relying on any other nation in the process.
IRIB English Radio. Thank you. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Legendary Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg and Nobel Prize winning peace activist Jody Williams, on Friday, December 4th, both joined a grassroots progressive campaign urging Joe Biden not to nominate Michelle Flourney as his Pentagon chief, warning her ties to the weapons industry, hawkish record, and current positions disqualify her for a powerful role. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Because She Was Wrong About Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, and Libya, Daniel Ellsberg Joins Campaign Against Flourney. Here's the details of this article. Legendary Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg and Nobel Prize-winning peace activist Jody Williams on Friday, December 4th, both joined a grassroots progressive campaign urging Joe Biden not to nominate Michelle Flourney as his Pentagon chief, warning her ties to the weapons industry, hawkish record, and current positions disqualify her for the powerful role. Flourney was wrong about Iraq, as Biden has acknowledged he was. But she was then also wrong about Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, and Libya, Ellsberg said in a statement released by RootsAction.org, part of a coalition of progressive advocacy groups pressuring the former vice president to pick a defense secretary committed to peace and without ties to the military-industrial complex. She's wrong right now in opposing the congressional ban on all arms sales to Saudi Arabia, and in planning to maintain minute man type land-based ICBMs, the hair trigger to the doomsday machine, Ellsberg continued. Her unquestioned intelligence and competence have long been in service to her serious interventionist misjudgments and to her own involvement in a revolving door military-industrial complex, he added. To the chagrin of progressives leading the charge against Flourney, the former Pentagon official has gained the support of some prominent organizations, including the Plowshares Fund and the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. Other anti-war groups have yet to speak out publicly about Flourney, who is still considered the Biden team's front runner for defense secretary. If Joe Biden really has a progressive agenda in mind for his administration, he should appoint members of his cabinet and other high-level positions who demonstrate progressive thinking and do not move this fractured country backwards, Williams said on Friday, December 4th. Nominating Michelle Flourney for defense secretary would not be forward thinking. We do not need a hawk with relationships with the weapons industry. During a call earlier this week, attended by representatives of more than 100 anti-war and nuclear disarmament groups, some participants resisted criticizing Flourney, who currently serves on the board of massive defense contractor Booz Allen Hamilton, over her industry ties. Mother Jones reported on Thursday, December 3rd, that Daryl Kimball, executive director of the Arms Control Association, said during the call that criticism of Flourney's ties to the defense industry could just as easily apply to the other nominees Biden is considering, a perhaps unintentionally damning assessment of Biden's other potential Pentagon nominees. According to the Wall Street Journal, other candidates in the running for the post include former Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson, a Lockheed Martin board member, and Jen Lloyd Austin, a Raytheon board member. Others who took part in the call, such as Code Pink co-founder Media Benjamin, were adamant that Flourney's militaristic record calls for nothing less than forceful opposition from progressives. It feels to me like this is a major, major concession of liberal foreign policy community, Benjamin told Mother Jones. It doesn't bode well for challenging the Biden administration on key foreign policy issues, she added. As The Intercept's Jeremy Schill wrote on Friday, December 4th, Flourney is a notorious hawk who backed the wars in Iraq, Syria, and Yemen and pushed for Obama to intervene in Libya. Flourney began her government career in Bill Clinton's administration, serving at the Pentagon, Schill noted. In 2005, at the height of the Bush-Cheney global war, Flourney joined a gaggle of mostly neocons at the notorious Project for the New American Century and criticizing the Bush administration for not being militaristic enough in its foreign policy and arguing for an increase in ground troops in the Middle East. Matthew Ho, a former State Department official who resigned in protest against the U.S. war in Afghanistan in 2009, said in a statement on Friday, December 4th, that he does not understand how the Democratic Party continues to embrace and promote the people responsible for this nation's unending wars. Flourney has been integral in the failed, counterproductive, and catastrophic wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, Pakistan, Syria, Libya, and across Saharan and sub-Saharan Africa, said Ho. Flourney's resume is conclusive evidence she will serve to justify massive Pentagon budgets, weapon sales to despots, and vainglorious wars, while bringing the colossal waste to U.S. taxpayers, death without purpose to American service members, and unending horror to tens of millions of people in the Muslim world.
Hi everyone, this is Don. Welcome back to another episode of our weekly show, The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we look into India's military presence in the Maldives. And we will explore the future of India's automobile industry.
With its thousands of islands stretching hundreds of kilometers into the Indian Ocean and straddling crucial sea lanes through which 40% of the world's fuel shipments flow, Maldives has always been a stage for strategic wrestling between both New Delhi and Beijing. For most of its independent history, since 1965, the South Asian archipelagic country has generally enjoyed excellent relations with India, while keeping communication channels open with China as both try to turn their tide in their direction in the Indian Ocean region.
The rapidly shifting geopolitical climate of the Indian Ocean is aggravated by Sino-Indian competition for influence in the Maldives. The island nation needs to upgrade its military capabilities through the acquisition of modern armaments, but apparently lack resources. Situated at the epicenter of a game between China and India for dominance of the Indian Ocean, it has to make the best use of its strategic geopolitical leverage. India has a long-standing relationship with neighboring the Maldives, but recently it is under threat amid a surge in anti-Indian sentiment. Maldivians have taken to social media and hit the streets to protest against India's military presence in their island nation, calling for Indian troops' unconditional and immediate departure. They describe it as a possible threat to their national sovereignty, with conspiracy theories circulating that the presence is a prelude to Indian annexation of Maldivian territory. Further narrowing India's earlier edge, China has made new inroads into the country via funding big infrastructure projects, including major island connecting bridges. Massive constructions in the island of Feidu Finolu, leased until 2016 by Beijing from the Maldivian government for $4 million, have also created rumors that China is establishing a military base there.
Widely perceived as pro-Indian, President Ibrahim Mohamed Soleh was elected with nearly 60% of the votes in 2018. Soleh beat out Abdullah Yameen Abdul Gayoom, who had prioritized closer ties with China. However, there is still speculation that Soleh's government is quietly trying to rebuild ties to China to financially assist its COVID-devastated economy.
India considers the countries in the Indian Ocean, including the Maldives, as part of its sphere of influence. To maintain a geopolitical balance, India has permanently stationed two helicopters and a Dornier surveillance aircraft in the Maldives under a long-standing bilateral defense pact. India has also helped establish a constellation of coastal radars aligned with its own grid on all 26 Maldivian atolls to monitor approaching sea vessels and aircraft. But the Indian reconnaissance aircraft and choppers deployed, along with the military personnel who operate them, is increasingly viewed with suspicion in the Maldives. Maldivians say no external power is allowed to have forces or facilities at any military base across the country's strategically located atolls following the withdrawal of British troops in 1976, nothing that only India continues to have a boots-on-the-ground presence. As a goodwill gesture to ease tensions, the Indian Navy has recently said that it had provided the Maldives National Defense Force with a Dornier aircraft as per an intergovernmental agreement. The aircraft will reportedly be based in the northern Maldivian base of Hani Madu and nominally be operated, commanded and controlled by the Maldivian military, with the Indian government bearing the aircraft's operating costs.
Now, for some insight, we are joined by Mr. Muad Mohamed Zaki, who is a senior member of Maldivian Democratic Party while in exile. He's a former political prisoner and currently a political activist and not part of any political party. Mr. Zaki, welcome to the Subcontinent. So, what is India's strategy to counter China's influence in Maldives?
Well, before the 2018 presidential elections, some of the leaders of the Maldivian Democratic Party, who are very close with President Modi, had actually already started various online campaigns basically targeting Chinese investments negatively. This has actually created fear and suspicion in Chinese investments in the country. that was followed by the Indian government's full backing of the Maldivian Democratic Party is led coalition in the Maldives to run against the pro-China President Yameen, Yameen's government. And after that, India has seen, and India is seen also to be received the backing of Saudi Arabia and the United States in plans for the Maldives. From the time the opposition won the elections, the Indian military has actually increased its presence in the country from north to south drastically. So this is a concern for a country like Maldives because we are a 100% Muslim country. And we also know the ongoing Kashmiri occupation by India. So this has caused a lot of fear in the country on India's ambitions in the country.
Okay, and what is China's approach to increase its influence in Maldives?
I do not think that China needs to do much other than to sit and watch. All they need to do is to wait and see, because no matter how much loans that India gives the government, the reality of the situation is that in times like COVID-19, no matter how much foreign loans are injected into the economy at the moment to keep it afloat, it is just a short-term solution. At the moment, the government does not seem to have any long-term solutions. The Indian government has taken full control of full advantage of our country's politicians' lack of understanding on international politics and military strategy. We must remind ourselves that the Maldives had only become a multi-party system in 2008, which is not long ago. Therefore, our politicians have not had the time to understand the big political backdoor games that international politics has in play. Nevertheless, China knows very well that if everything else fails, be it this government or the next government, the Maldives will go back to China for help, because China has proven that when it comes to development, it does carry through, even if there are questions to be asked on specific investments.
All right, Mr. Zaki, what is the result of this rivalry for people of the Maldives?
The supporters from both sides of politics has seen that this foreign interference in our country's domestic affairs has wasted a lot of our government's time that could have been actually spent better in planning for the COVID-19 impact on our economy. Supporters of the ruling coalition parties has also been voicing their concern over India's growing military activities in the country and the worsening economic situation. However, their leaders have not given actually much satisfactory answers to the party members. I think this is one of the reasons why the Election Commission had recently announced that the party membership of the ruling coalition party, Maldivian Democratic Party, has been decreasing, while the opposition party's party membership has actually been increasing. I think the Indian government seem to be the only one benefiting from this. They are effectively now controlling our foreign policy as well. At the OIC or any other international platforms, the Maldives seem to be busy defending India instead of finding much-needed assistance for Maldivian families, small businesses, homeowners and renters. Everyone is suffering in the Maldives.
Mr. Zaki, please, let's just take a look at how the global media has covered this situation and then we can continue.
India has taken a lead over China in their contest for influence in the Maldives. New Delhi would fund the implementation of the Greater Malay Connectivity Project through a $100 million grant and a $400 million line of credit. The project is a 6.7-kilometer long bridge and causeway link that will connect the Maldivian capital Male with the neighboring islands of Vilengili, Gulifau, and Thilafushi. It also includes the building of a port at Gulifahu and an industrial zone in Thilafushi. Unlike a similar initiative 7 years ago, the new framework for cooperation between the US and Maldivian Departments of Defense went through without objection from India, a leading player in the latest version of the South Asian Great Game in which China, Japan and the US are contesting for influence. India is also part of Quad, an alliance that includes Australia, Japan, and the US. They have held security dialogues and military exercises spanning the Pacific and Indian Ocean.
All right, thank you for staying with us. Now, do you think the people or government of Maldives favor one over the other?
I do not think the Maldives government or the people really favor one over another. The Maldivians are loving people. We love people from all countries and religions. We want to get along with all countries except for apartheid Israel. We wish India and China both invest in our countries together. There are plenty of space for both to actually invest in, where we all can benefit together. However, India bringing in their military instead of infrastructure projects, then it's not good for the government or the people or the country. The current situation is that once we had let the Trojan horse into the country, we are now stuck with them. There is no easy solution to the current situation. That's the scary part. Let's say in the future, if the government asks the Indian military to leave the country, will they leave? Like, I don't think so.
Mr. Zaghi, thank you so much for being on our show. Let's see how people on social media see this situation.
Using the hashtag India Out, Muson Baharu believes the presence of the Indian military in Maldives is unconstitutional and completely illegitimate. Ahmed Azan suggests that people need to show their aversion to the Indian military presence in the country. And regarding the tweet of Hassan Ali, although he has a positive view of India and its people, he opposes any foreign military presence in Maldives and considers it a violation to the country's sovereignty.
You're listening to the Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to the Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Driving is not for the faint of heart in India, whose streets are perhaps the most dangerous ones in the world. Indian traffic drives on the left, but most of its drivers are in the middle of the road paying little heed to the rules and doing anything they can to avoid queuing. According to a 2007 report, more than 130,000 people die on the roads of India. India needs to revamp its transportation and design new traffic management systems. But how?
The future of the automobile industry will probably be either electric or hybrid. Future cars will either do all the driving or the human at the helm can steer the wheel sometimes to manipulate a decision. For a country with crazy streets, air pollution, and an enormously big market, it can also have unexpected social and political as well as economic consequences. Electric cars have zero emissions and self-driving cars reduce the casualties tremendously, but they are expensive and require supporting infrastructure. Creating or importing infrastructure mean investment by foreign firms. This may disrupt the indigenous car manufacturing industry and even increase dependency on US technology. The Indian automobile market is so gigantic and fast flourishing that almost everybody wants to have a bit of it. Washington is more than eager to invest in the country's car market, but some believe it only aims to decrease and counter China's share in the market as part of its trade war with China. Recent trends suggest a rise in the interest among the common masses for electric cars. With such prospects for profit, who will manage to help India switch over from conventional petrol diesel-powered cars to electric or hybrid self-driving vehicles?
Business magnate and industrial designer Elon Musk has recently said that the United States electric vehicle and clean energy company Tesla will make its entry into India in 2021. It can simply be a propaganda gimmick, as it has happened before. In 2016, Musk said that the company would launch the Tesla 3 model in India with a countrywide supercharger network. However, this has not happened. In 2018, Musk said he had plans to begin Tesla operations in India in 2019, but this too did not come to fruition.
Raucous and unruly traffic isn't the only problem in the Indian streets. In its road for the adoption of electric vehicles or self-driving cars, India faces numerous environmental, economic, and social challenges. In addition to measures aimed at elevating mundane issues such as the absence of road signs, dangerous potholes, and poorly maintained footpaths, India has to build nationwide charging infrastructure. It needs high-tech battery production lines, and it must consider the supply-demand gap as well as creating a closed loop. Shortage of homegrown battery cells in India will increase the dependency on imports from Japan, China, Korea, and Europe, as well as the US. Hence, the Indian government needs to incentivize indigenous manufacturers towards technologies better suited for the country's market, such as aluminium fuel cells. The establishment of a robust supply chain is also crucial for automakers to make the shift feasible. Moreover, recycling stations must be set up to recover the metals from batteries to create the closed loop required for the transition to electric cars to be an environmentally sound decision. India wants over one-third of vehicles electric by 2030, but the goal seems fantastically out of reach unless it introduces more incentives, tax cuts, or rebates that benefit all stakeholders in the process.
To learn more about this, we now have with us Mr. Paranjoy Guha Thakurta, who's an Indian author, journalist, and commentator on economic and political affairs. Mr. Thakurta, welcome to the show. So, how successful do you see the auto industry in India?
Thank you for inviting me to your program, and I must say that the auto industry is in a very, very bad shape at present. I think never in the history of India's automobile industry has the situation been as bad as it has present. For the first time since the automobile industry was set up many, many decades ago, in the month of April 2020, there were no sales, zero sales of any kind of automobile, from heavy vehicles, that is trucks and lorries, to personalized vehicles, passenger cars, to buses, to even two-wheelers, motorcycles and mopeds and scooters. This has never happened before. This is the first time it's happened. And on top of it, you have the heavy vehicles, like the commercial vehicles, the trucks and the lorries and the buses. Their sales have come down much more than the sales of two-wheelers like scooters and motorcycles and mopeds. And it is not just a demand recession which is affecting India's automotive industry, but also the switch over to new emission norms. In a sense, the industry has gone back to where it was 4 or 5 years ago. And these are the figures. If you go to the official industry association, the Society of Indian Automobile Manufacturers, you will see the numbers are there for you to check yourself. On top of all that, the insurance numbers the insurance payments have gone up, the prices of the vehicles have gone up, and banks have tightened the norms on which they give loans to individuals to buy the vehicles, or even to not just individuals, to organizations and corporate entities. So a combination of all these factors, demand recession, a new switch, emission norms, insurance policies, the premium has gone up, increase in prices, all of this has resulted in the Indian automobile industry going through a huge crisis. I would say the biggest ever crisis in the history of India's automotive industry.
Mr. Thakurta, before moving ahead with the next questions, let's see the media views regarding this problem.
To make an autonomous car safe, developers need to make it as smart as humans, at least in certain respects. To negotiate the unruly Delhi traffic, driverless cars need a whole different level of smarts. In Western cities, traffic rules are followed, signs are obeyed, and the right of way is given, not taken. It's anything but so in Delhi and countless other Indian cities. In a country like India, with a little over 1.3 billion people, any policy decision that may impact jobs appears justifiable at first blush. Why then is India insistent on introducing electric vehicles that may help unclog the air to some extent but destroy many jobs in the traditional auto sector? The most challenging part in electric vehicle manufacturing is producing lithium-ion batteries. Therefore, the government has to play an essential role in it. Only then the final price of EV will be decreased. According to a report, the price of lithium-ion battery can reduce by up to 80%. That only requires a larger volume of production. If government is unable to achieve significant battery clusters, India's plan to transition to EVs will never be fulfilled.
All right, welcome back, Mr. Thakurta. So, how much do you think politics affects this industry?
I think politics has not got that much of an impact. It is more the economic situation. The slowdown in the economy, the recession, the demand recession that is in the economy. Now, if you look at up to the end of March of 2020, for the last 2 years, we are seeing India's gross domestic product, or GDP, the rate of growth has been constantly slowing down. Then you had the pandemic, and on top of that, you had the economic lockdown, which was a very, very harsh lockdown, which started from the midnight of the 24th of March, 2020. So we've seen a huge migration of people, internal migration within India. So all of these factors, the combination of all these factors and the economic recession has resulted in the India's automobile industry being in the state that it is. Now, yes, of course, everything is impacted by politics. You could argue if the government of India headed by Mr. Narendra Modi, who is the leader of the BJP, the Bharatiya Janata Party, which is a right-wing Hindu nationalist political party, if the lockdown was less harsh, then maybe the recession and the demand recession would have impacted the industry less. But that's now a thing of the past. Automobile sales had been going down for some time, even before the pandemic and the lockdown. And the pandemic and the lockdown has resulted in things worsening very, very much, very, very badly. And as I mentioned right at the beginning, for the first time in the history of India's automobile industry, in August 2020, there were no sales, zero sales.
Mr. Thakurta, thank you so much for being with us on our show. It was very nice having you here. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media and cyberspace.
The official Twitter account of Mint refers to Nitin Gadkari, the road transport minister, that the government plans to make India an automobile manufacturing hub in the next 5 years. Also, these two tweets of the Press Information Bureau contain more details about the minister's words and the government's plan in the field of electric vehicles, taking steps in reducing the air pollution, and so on.
And that was our episode covering the rift in Maldives between India and China and the Indian automobile industry. We'll meet next week.
This is IRIB English Radio. IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello. I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Iran is a vast land. My beautiful country, Iran, is the land of high mountains, scorching hot deserts, deep blue seas, and green rainy forests. The cities of each of these spectacular regions have their special characteristics. Today, I'm going to the city of Rasht in order to visit the municipality square plaza of this pretty city. The municipality square plaza of Rasht has been known as the city center since long time ago. This square and its surrounding buildings have been built inspired by neoclassical architecture. The architecture of this historical complex resembles that of a street in St. Petersburg in Russia. The municipality square complex of Rasht has been built by Iranian architects residing in Rasht. The municipality square plaza of Rasht consists of the municipal building, the clock tower, the post and telegraph building, the national library, and the ancient building of the Iran Hotel. I am now in the municipality square plaza of Rasht. It's raining elegantly and it's really pleasing to walk in such an atmosphere. Oh, look at here! How many doves are here? Kind residents of Rasht throw seeds on the ground for these doves, and here, this location has been transformed into a really pretty picture of fascinating birds. I have to keep in mind that next time that I come back here, bring some seeds with myself for these birds. What a thunder! It's raining so heavily now. Thank God I brought an umbrella with myself. Well, I better put up my umbrella before I'm soaked to the skin. Well, it's better now. Now I can walk safely in the plaza. The walls of the buildings in this square are all white in color. They also have wooden windows and bars. The windows are arched. This special architecture gives a unique beauty and calm to this place. I am now standing by the clock tower of the municipality square of Rasht. This beautiful clock chimes every hour as many times as the hour, and it also chimes every 30 minutes by a single bell. The clock tower of the municipality square of Rasht was damaged after an earthquake in 1990, but fortunately it was repaired immediately. Standing by the traditional bazaar of Rasht. Wow! The smell of fish, hot fumani cookies, and kebabs of Rasht have all filled the atmosphere of this beautiful bazaar. This bazaar smells the life. I better set another time to make a trip here for having a complete visit of this gorgeous bazaar and to purchase lots of things. Oh well, it's spitting right now, and I'd better fold my umbrella. You know, I love walking in the rain when it pours lightly. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Round the World with Reporters.
The Islamic Republic of Iran currently has the highest blood donation rate in the Eastern Mediterranean region. And out of almost 10 million donation units in this region, over 2 million is by the Iranians. These days, a campaign is launched in Tehran to collect blood from athletes to encourage other people to donate their blood. The campaign is being promoted by Sports Society of Basij in collaboration with the country's blood transfusion organization.
We have organized this event to give the opportunity to athletes and other people to donate their blood to improve the level of blood banks in the country.
Famous sportsmen also took part to convince ordinary people to be part of the Movable.
I am here today to donate my blood because it's a must for everyone to help the patients. Our country needs our blood, as the bank reservoirs are running low. I call on my fellow countrymen to come and help and save lives.
I want to be part of this campaign to do the least I can do for those who need blood. This can also improve the health in our country. As the body of athletes is strong, their blood is of a better quality. I ask all the athletes to show up and assist.
Studies showed that the plasma taken from the recovered people can be used in treating the coronavirus patients. While blood donation in many countries still depends on replacement or paid donors, Iran is the first country in the region that has enjoyed voluntary blood donation by 100% since 2007. Human Abedi, Tehran.
The humanitarian crisis in Yemen has been exacerbated by the incessant war and siege over the past 6 years. The executive director of the World Food Program, David Beasley, confirmed that the number of people facing the second highest level of food insecurity will increase from 3.6 million to 5 million in the first half of 2021.
There is indeed a humanitarian catastrophe, and if aid arrives, it goes to other places, and 70% of it goes to United Nations organizations to cover operational expenses. The other side must stop the blockade completely, because it affects Yemen in the medical, educational, and food sectors. So we think the focus should be on the root cause of the problem, which is the siege on Yemeni people.
Beasley called on the international community not to abandon the millions of families who are in severe need of aid. Millions of people are on the brink of a new famine as the UN's Yemen response faces historic shortfalls. $1.5 billion is what the donor governments contributed, while the UN says it needs $3.2 billion to avert the crisis.
Those who provide aid, such as the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and America, have failed and did not abide by their pledges they made. They spent more than these sums to buy weapons, but they do not help Yemenis as they claim, which confirms the authenticity of the United Nations reports that famine is on the rise in Yemen.
The coronavirus pandemic, along with the funding crunch, has forced dozens of aid agencies and organizations working in Yemen to scale back their assistance. Some of them even had to give up their programs entirely, which has deteriorated the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, according to the UN. Famine can still be prevented if the international community wakes up to take serious action to save the lives of millions in Yemen, including women and the children. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The coordination Stop Global Security Law organized a new popular march for liberties and for justice all over France. The protesters want a total withdrawal of a law recently voted in the French Parliament that limits the possibility to film the police. They also denounce an authoritarian drift of the French government.
That authoritarian drift is evident. Look to the proposed laws. The existing legal framework in France is more than sufficient to control everything they want to. Why do they add new laws? It's only to limit more the freedom of expression and to sanction activists.
Trade unions say that the French government is taking advantage of the COVID-19 crisis to implement anti-social and austerity measures like the privatization of the health sector and the dismissal of workers.
They use the Terrorist Act and the health crisis as an alibi for restrictive measures. Since last week, the head of police has forbidden a demonstration in the name of the COVID-19 crisis. This law has only one interest, to silence demonstrators.
Earlier this week, the Council of Ministers decided to close the main association against Islamophobia in France, the CCIF. French Interior Minister Darmanin qualified the CCIF as an enemy of the Republic and accused it of incitement to hatred and violence, discrimination, and of encouraging terrorism.
That's very surprising, because the CCIF has always profiled itself on the judicial scene and very little as political activists. The association limited itself to defend the legitimate rights of the Muslims. Now, in the context of an upsurge of terrorist attacks since 2015, the French government has entered in a phase of escalation of repressive measures that seriously limit the democratic liberties.
Amnesty International declared that dissolving the CCIF is a violation of freedom of association. As for now, the French government remains inflexible towards a social protest. The tensions are rising in high government circles about the way the security issue in France is handled. The protesters promise not to give up until an important part of the law is cancelled. Chris Denhant, Paris.
Due to the coronavirus pandemic, the European Defence Agency annual conference has taken place online. The event, which has just concluded, normally attracts protests as it brings together arms dealers, policymakers and politicians, while civil society representatives are banned. The usual rhetoric was peddled out at this year's conference, however.
We have to look together into the rise of China and also these issues. Speaking of Russia, they have developed, and they are developing as we speak, super advanced missile systems.
Campaigners say the EU and NATO create security threats to feed the arms industry, which is active in every one of the EU's 27 nations and has an annual turnover of more than 100 billion euro. The ongoing process to create an EU army means that even more taxpayers' money is being spent at a time when COVID-19 is pushing millions of citizens into poverty.
For the first time, we invest 8 billion euros of EU budget money in cooperative defence R&D project.
Activists describe the EU's arms industry as immoral.
Exporting weapons to the Saudi-led coalition, which is waging war on Yemen. You have these huge amounts of money being made on the suffering of the Palestinian people.
Donald Trump's Make America Great Again slogan was mocked during the EU Defence Agency conference.
I very much hope that with Joe Biden we will have a partner in making, we have already started saying, making multilateralism great again.
The anti-war movement is suggesting those who believe we will have a more just world under Joe Biden's presidency should examine the history books.
The Obama-Biden team ordered 10 times more airstrikes using drones than the previous U.S. administration under George W. Bush. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Protest in Pakistan against the UAE was unthinkable until recently. However, now it is not so unusual after the UAE diplomatically recognized the apartheid regime of Israel. The public sentiments against several Arab rulers rose in Pakistan after the UAE and Bahrain started aligning their foreign policies with Israel and India. The normalization of Israel's ties with the UAE and Bahrain is now affecting Islamabad's long-standing relation with some Arab rulers, particularly of Saudi Arabia and UAE. Citing unspecified security threats and rise in coronavirus cases, the UAE now has banned visit and work visas to Pakistani citizens, along with 13 other Muslim nations, most of whom have been angry with Abu Dhabi after it normalized ties with Tel Aviv.
Countries like UAE receive such direct investment from investors from Israel and, for that matter, American Jewish community. Then obviously the UAE government and the investors from Israel or, for that matter, USA would be cautious about how the local population, for that matter, how the immigrants might react and respond to direct presence of the Israeli or, for that matter, American Jewish investors in countries like UAE.
Without revealing their names, Prime Minister Imran Khan in a recent interview dropped a hint that Saudi Arabia and the UAE have been pressurizing Islamabad to normalize its ties with Israel. Islamabad has vowed not to give diplomatic recognition to Israel. Over 5 million Pakistanis work in UAE and Saudi Arabia, the two biggest remittance-generating Arab states.
Pakistan's economy is dependent on these remittances. Saudi Arabia and UAE have the tools in their hands to put pressure on Pakistan to recognize Israel. Pakistan's nuclear power has always been a problem for Israel. So therefore, Israel would love that Pakistan should give recognition to it. That's why UAE, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain,